Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the Now Hear This, Canby podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Martina Baker, and this is what's happening this week in our community. The Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission announced plans this week to build a new warehouse for statewide liquor distribution at the Baker Center property in the Canby Industrial Park. The OLCC approved a sales agreement for the 20-acre property on Southeast First Avenue in a special meeting on Tuesday. The choice of the Canby Baker Center property, offered by commercial real estate developer Trammell Crow, comes almost 4 years after the OLCC estimated its current warehouse wouldn't have the capacity to meet future consumer demand. The COVID-19 pandemic has also driven changes in the commercial real estate market that have reduced the availability of large parcels of land, officials said, and increased material and labor costs associated with large-scale construction projects. Without added capacity, the OLCC's ability to store and supply liquor products would level off, as would revenue generated to support state programs. A site survey team had originally identified 4 suitable locations, only one of which, Canby, was still available. Fortunately, it also happened to be the commission's top choice. The new Canby warehouse would combine inventory from and replace the 2 facilities it currently uses for storing product. The main OLCC currently in use would need to be seismically retrofitted to remain serviceable, and the Delawette study confirmed that wouldn't be cost-effective, according to the agency. Earlier this month, the Oregon legislature approved an increase in the OLCC's bonding authority for the proposed warehouse because of the market-wide rise in construction costs. In 2019, the project was expected to cost $62.6 million. 3 years later, it is more than double to $145.8 million. The new distribution center will enable the OLCC to increase the number of products sold and distributed statewide. The sale of those increased offerings is expected to generate enough money to pay back the construction bonds in less than a year. The saga of a slate of controversial Planning Commission appointments that provoked the ire of some elected officials and residents in Canby took another turn Wednesday with the revelation of a prior conversation between 2 councilors that may have constituted a violation of Oregon public meetings law. The original appointment on January 5th elevated Chris Calkins, Dan Ewert, and Judy Jaroche to fill 3 vacancies on the city planning body in a 3-2-1 vote, with councilors David Bajorin, Chris Bangs, and Greg Parker in favor. Council President Tracy Hensley and Councilor Sean Varwig sharply opposed, and Councilor Sarah Spoon abstaining. Spoon and Calkins are married. Tensions arose over the majority's decision to reject the recommendations by Varwig and Mayor Brian Hodson to instead name Ewert, Matthew Ellison, and Michael Nick Cousin to the board, an option under the city charter, but one that is rarely exercised. In the ensuing fallout, Varwig filed a far-reaching public records request seeking email, text, and other conversations between the four counselors in the lead-up to the Planning Commission appointments, and also dating back to November 2020. Among the documents uncovered by the request was a Facebook Messenger thread Bajoran turned in detailing a conversation between Parker and himself on December 30th of last year. In the 7-page conversation, Parker expounds on the upcoming Planning Commission appointments and several issues he found to be problematic in the recommendation process. The problem is, he also refers to discussions with two or three other counselors while chatting with Bajoran, several references to separate conversation with Bangs and Varwig, as well as a mention of Spoon's plans to abstain from the matter. Oregon law prohibits a quorum of elected officials from discussing or deliberating business when not properly noticed or in view of the public, except in narrow exceptions in which closed sessions are permitted. It also prohibits, for example, City Councilor A from discussing a pending matter with Councilor B and then sharing that conversation with Councilor C and so on, which is known as a serial meeting. In an email to Now Hear This, Canby, City Attorney Joe Lindsay stressed that he did not necessarily believe the Facebook chat between Parker and Bajoran constituted a serial meeting or that any violation of public meetings law had occurred, but he admitted it was possible a judge might see it that way if the matter were ever taken to court. Because of the potential that the four counselors' actions might be seen as a violation of public records law, Lindsay advised that the council revote on the three Planning Commission appointments. This would insulate the city, though not necessarily the individual counselors, from any future claims or complaints related to the January 5th vote, Lindsay said. But the course of action did not sit well with Hensley or Varwig, who described the recommendation as just do a revote to basically cover our asses. While that is an option available to us, I would like to say that it is my belief that to vote the same way as the meeting in question, just to fix a mistake, would be a violation of your integrity, and I hope no one would do that to the citizens of Canby, Varwig said to his colleagues. I'm disappointed in our attorney and our city manager for putting us in an even more precarious position when this information is released to the public, which it has been tonight, and the public learns that we covered up a mistake. Ultimately, the revote was identical to the original vote on January 5th, 3-2-1, with Varwig and Hensley opposed and Spoon abstaining. For a longer version of this story, visit our website at canbefirst.com. Canby Mayor Brian Hodson returned to the podium for his once annual State of the City speech Thursday evening, the first time he had delivered such a speech in more than 2 years. It's hard to imagine a more eventful 24 months that could have transpired, and simply summarizing the good, the bad, and the ugly was the first challenge facing Hodson at the event. We have dealt with fires, ice storms, and of course, an ever-changing virus, Hodson said. We have had elections that brought a new leadership at a national, state, county, and city level. Through it all, the Canby community has been tested in a myriad of ways and has often, though not always, chosen the path of offering a hand rather than making a fist. Mask or not to mask, Austin said of conflicts that have at times seemed ever present in the streets of Canby and on social media. Vaccination or not to vaccinate. Neighbors helping neighbors fight fires, move animals, running supplies, volunteering at the fairgrounds, opening their homes to those without power. Lending of generators, heaters, and other light sources. Helping neighbors clear down trees and limbs. Supporting the line crews that worked hours on end to restore power. That is the Canby that I love to be a part of, and that you love to be a part of. As in past years before the pandemic, the city partnered with the Canby Area Chamber of Commerce to present the State of City as a joint event, also showcasing more than a dozen local businesses. Hodson highlighted the explosion of industrial development in Canby over the past 2 years, including the new distribution and production facilities of Stanton Furniture and Caruso Produce, the expansion of Dragonberry Produce that is currently underway, and Amazon's planned 517,000 square foot sortation facility on South Township Road. The increased truck and employee traffic such developments inevitably will bring also heightens the need for the planned Walnut Road extension, which will provide an outlet for northbound vehicles leaving the industrial park. Hodson said that from the latest session of the Oregon legislature came some good news. For this project anyway, the state has agreed to allocate $2.96 million toward the project. The mayor credited new state representative James Heave and Senator Bill Kenemer with securing the funds for Canby. Downtown, Hodson applauded the arrivals of Siren Song, King's Farm to Table, and Art-O-Matic, as well as the forthcoming Canby Beer Library that will soon be taking shape in the former City Library, the building on North Holly Street. On the urban renewal front, the city recently took advantage of historically low interest rates and refinanced its remaining URA debt, resulting in a savings of over $6 million for the remaining life of the district. The Urban Renewal Agency is currently considering its options on how to best make use of the savings, which could include additional projects or closing the district early. In the past year, Canby has celebrated the return of many major city-sponsored events, including the Big Night Out Street Dance, Downtown Trick-or-Treating, Light Up the Night at Waite Park, and the First Thursday Night Market. That trend will continue this summer, Hodson revealed, confirming the return of the Canby Independence Day celebration and 4th of July fireworks show, which drew cheers from the crowd at the Antonio Ballroom above the Backstop Bar and Grill. Numerous challenges remain for the city and its leaders to navigate, he admitted. Among those, the continuing COVID-19 pandemic, staff and workforce shortages, the ongoing recovery from the devastating February 2021 ice storm, and a rise in mental health-related calls. Add to that list housing and transportation needs, complications associated with industrial park development, questions surrounding parks and recreation, and an increased demand for water, power, and sewage common to a growing community. These successes are from a period of challenges, Hodson said, a time of checking and adjusting to the times. We have much to plan for in the coming years. It will require very tough decisions by the City Council and the citizens of Canby. The Canby Way has meant different things to different people over the years. To me, the Canby Way is the community that does not divide. It's the one that comes together in times of need to help a neighbor. Let's be that Canby all the time. Kim Atkins, owner of Canby Trophies and Awards, is used to meeting the needs of clients looking to honor all manner of achievements, but it's not often that she finds herself on the receiving end. That changed last month when the Downtown Trophy Shop was recognized as a 25-year member of the Awards and Personalization Association at its annual convention in Las Vegas. 14 other companies also received the honor from the Chicago-based association for the nation's retailers and suppliers of personalized and customized items. Atkins has owned Canby Trophies for 14 of the more than 25 years that it's been in business. Past two have undoubtedly brought the most challenges as COVID-19 severely impacted the in-person events and athletic leagues that would normally form the bulk of her customer base. It's different now, she explained. People aren't doing as much as they used to. It's been a struggle for sure, but events are slowly starting to come back, and that's been good for everybody. People have been able to start giving out awards again, which is a lot better than having to receive them through the mail. Atkins credited the permanence of a trophy or award, something that the digital world, with all of its trappings, still can't replace, with helping her survive, along with the support of the community. It gives you something to hold on to, she said. Something you can hold in your hand is way better than seeing a picture of it. And I have to thank the community for coming back time and time again. Truly thinking local before going elsewhere is a big help. Without the community, this place wouldn't still be here after 25 years. Cougar Country Hometown Sports Coverage is brought to you by Reif and Hunsaker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. For the latest sports news, follow us on Twitter at Cougar Country OR and Instagram at Cougar Country POD. The Clackamas Community College wrestling team found itself in a familiar place Friday, on top. The Cougars finished first in the National Junior College Athletic Association National Championships, outpacing Iowa Central by 9.5 points in the team race and clinching the national title for the fourth consecutive year. This was a very remarkable group of young men who came together to achieve something very exceptional, CCC wrestling head coach Josh Roden said. They believed in their training, each other, and trusted the process, which I think is why we saw some of our best wrestling at the end of the year. The contest came down to the wire with four Cougars in the championship final and one win needed to seal CCC's victory and prevent a comeback from Iowa Central. When CCC's Alex Ramirez came out triumphant in the 157-pound weight class, he secured the national championship, not only for himself, but his team as well. The win marks the Cougars' fourth national championship in a row, the program's sixth championship overall, and the fifth during Roden's tenure. Our coaches did a great job preparing this team, and I want to thank them for their time and effort, Roden said. This team was inspired, selfless, and hardworking, and that reflects the coaching staff. In other individual results, Justin Mejia, Marcus Branford, and Steele Starin were the national runners-up in their respective weight classes. Victor Jacinto clinched third at 149, Nicholas Aguilar fourth at 125, and Michael Gaspar fifth at 197. Trent Silva and Kyle Richards contributed points with sixth-place finishes. Romeo Manui was the only Cougar to fail to place, compiling a 2-2 record in the national tourney.
Hey, Tyler. Read any good books lately?
Yeah, actually, I'm reading a really good one right now.
Awesome. What's it about?
It's kind of complicated, but there's like these two kids with an absent parent, and then this mysterious stranger shows up with his sinister accomplices, and they just start wreaking havoc in their lives. I think it's like a Faustian metaphor.
Wow, that sounds really dense.
It is.
Interesting, though. Who wrote it?
You know, I think it's like a doctor, starts with like an S or something, Sass, Sos.
Tyler, are you reading The Cat in the Hat?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to. It's taken me like 2 months to get this far.
Okay. Well, hey, whatever your interest or reading level, open the world of all things books at the Book Nook in downtown Canby.
Yeah, guys, this local, independently owned and operated store is your one-stop shop for the latest releases and great deals on a huge variety of previously owned books, as well as games, art, and writing supplies and gifts.
They also do book clubs and game nights if you're looking for some fun, healthy activities right here in Canby. And hey, you know, for you, Tyler, they have a really expansive selection of children's books.
Oh, cool. Anyway, check them out on Facebook and Instagram, online at booknookcanby.com, or stop by 294 Northwest 2nd Avenue and let their friendly staff introduce you to your new favorite read. Hey, Frankie, why do you think I'd be interested in children's books?
We'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay.
It's back. Hosted by the Canby Rotary Club, Canby's inaugural Daddy-Daughter Dance was one of the first local events to be postponed due to the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in March 2020. Now, 2 years later, the need for parents, kids, families, and the community to come together, reconnect, and have a little fun is greater than ever. Here's Canby Rotary President and event organizer Ray Keene.
So the Daddy-Daughter Dance is really just coming online at, I think, a really important time for the relationships that are really core in our community. When you think about opportunities to come together with a father and a daughter to connect, or other meaningful relationships, we're really open to all coming. So, you know, when those relationships are kind of when they've been hammered the way that the last couple of years have, you know, really impacted all of our relationships, I think it's really an important time for dads and daughters to be able to get together and do something that's really special.
So join us for an evening of fun, food, magic, music, and of course, dancing from 6 to 9 p.m. Saturday, March 12th at the Ackerman Center in Canby. The night will include a chocolate fountain, refreshments, arts and crafts, a photo booth, a live magic show, and other surprises that are sure to amaze and delight the little princess in your life. Tickets are $30 per couple and $10 for every additional child, with all proceeds supporting the work of Canby Rotary and its charitable efforts in our community. All are welcome at this fun, friendly, and inclusive event. For tickets or more information, visit canbyrotary.com. Joining us on the Canby Conversation today is Allie Thomas. She is the Family Outreach Coordinator at Willamette Connections Academy. Hi, Allie.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. Thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely. We're delighted to have you on. Why don't you start by telling us, for folks who may not know, what is the Willamette Connections Academy?
Absolutely. So we are a K through 12 public charter school. But the fun part about our program is we operate all online. And prior to the pandemic, it seemed kind of like a specialty school. But now that we have gone through the last few years, people understand a little bit more about virtual education. But what
Right. It's kind of funny to think back when that used to be a niche thing.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, the pandemic kind of validated us. It felt really nice to be like, oh, this is a thing and it actually works. Okay.
Right.
So what makes us stand out at Willamette Connections Academy is that we've been doing this for more than 20 years. Within the state of Oregon, we've been at it for about 16 or 17. And then as a whole, we've been doing it for more than 20 years in the Connections Academy family. So we are proud because we are pioneers in virtual education and we're kind of experts in virtual education. Our teachers are trained in how to engage families in an online setting. We're built around being online. So it's, a little different than what some folks have experienced in terms of virtual education, because this is just our norm. This is what we do and we're built for it.
Right. To that end, I'd love to ask, and this is probably a little bit of a two-part question, because I'm sure the landscape has changed after the pandemic as we've been talking, but what types of students and families would normally, choose online learning and be a part of, look at being part of your academy, I guess, before COVID and now in our current environment? What are you kind of seeing as far as that goes?
Yeah, so it's interesting and it has changed because of the pandemic. So So I'm going to back up and talk. Prior to the pandemic, what we saw was really a wide range of students and families seeking us out. Uh-huh. We had, we had families or students that were competitive in sports or extracurricular activities that really needed that flexible schedule to accommodate their practices or their travel schedules. So kids that are in 4-H and rodeo, we have had a lot of actors and actresses come through our virtual doors.
Oh, cool.
And a lot of, like I said, athletes, kids that, swimmers and kids that have to, practice early in the morning and then practice again later, or, so that was kind of one component that it really attracted. We've also had a lot of military families over the years, people that needed just that flexibility that they might not always be right at home or near their zone school. We also serve a large population in rural communities. They might have just one school in their area or, maybe a couple choices and maybe that didn't work for one reason or another. That is another population that is always, we've always had a pretty good foot in the door. And then we've had families that have students with special needs. And what helps, what is beneficial for families with special needs is that these kids are working at home in an environment that they're most comfortable with the people that know them best. So it's really, it can be very safe and comforting for them. They're not being pulled out to go to this service or that service. Now, we do have those services and they are getting that support. They just aren't, there's no stigma surrounding it. So sometimes that can be what attracts families. But we also just have families that want to be engaged in their students' learning. So that is, you know, just your kind of run-of-the-mill family where the families just really want to be active and engaged. So that was kind of our enrollment prior to the pandemic. And then when the pandemic happened and schools went virtual, a lot of families sought us out because we were the name in virtual education. We had the long-term history behind us. And so, you know, families came to us for kind of that comfortability, knowing that, oh, this they might know what they're doing maybe a little bit better than my neighborhood school. Now, we totally credit the neighborhood schools and everybody for cobbling together what they did. It was not an easy feat, and everybody absolutely did their best. But some families just wanted that support from a school that has been doing the virtual learning for quite some time. And then, you know, we thought when the pandemic ended, or I mean, not that it's ended, or, you know, we thought with things kind of opening back up that we might see families shift back. But we're seeing a lot of those families stay. They're happy with what they're doing, because it's just it's a model that's working for a lot of our families.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I'm interested in digging a little deeper into where you were going there just at the end. Definitely not looking to, and it sounds like you're not either, sort of disparage, you know, schools that were doing their best with these mandates and things that came down and, you know, continued to change over the past couple of years. But in general, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of frustrations parents have had with when we were in the distance learning environment and some of those things. It almost became a little bit of a dirty word for some people, online learning. What are some of the things that in your long history of doing this, much longer, you know, way before COVID-19 was ever heard of, what are maybe some of the tricks that you could share, some things that you kind of found through that process that helped you guys be very effective in this kind of environment?
Yeah, no. And thank you again for clarifying that. We are so happy that everybody did we know that everybody did the best that they can, and students were getting absolutely the best that they could get from the schools that they were being served by. But I think what made us stand out is, just like I said, we're built 100% around being virtual. So we have an online platform that is a safe and secure platform, meaning there's no outside influences that can penetrate the Connexus system. It is, they can't get spam from outside sources or be, you know, sent into links of things that may or may not be safe. So we're happy with that piece. And then all of our curriculum is embedded within the system. So our families didn't have to, you know, bounce from, one site to another to get this piece and go into this piece and that piece. You know, we do, of course, use outside resources with the help of our teachers, but we try to keep things all under one umbrella to make it easier on the family. So we're happy that we have our Connexus system. We also have our online classrooms. We have what we call our live lesson room, which again is a safe and secure system. So we don't have people coming in from the outside, like Zoom bombing, which is a term that I think joined the zeitgeist in this pandemic. And so we do have teachers that use Zoom, but they have really learned how to make that safe and secure for our families. But I think it was just the fact that our teachers knew how to navigate the online world, had the resource built and organized, and then we're able to just keep the kids engaged and learning and moving forward. So we feel like we didn't, you know, when the world shut down, most of us were like, oh, so we're just still at home and learning and teaching, and like our day-to-day life didn't really change with Connexus Academy. So that felt actually kind of comforting in a way.
Yeah, that's kind of funny to think about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You felt ahead of the game.
Yeah. And we did, you know, definitely as a company as a whole and as a school as a whole, really try and offer resources and support to teachers to help them navigate the virtual world.
Yeah.
So we were pretty proud of that. I know there are a lot of, you know, social media pages and whatnot that were like, if you need help, if you need to figure this out, you just let us know. And a lot of teachers that I know across the Connexus Academy universe, like, we're ready and willing to jump in and make sure teachers felt supported as they embarked on this too.
Yeah. Yeah. So like procedurally and environmentally, kind of what the overall day looked like for you guys didn't change so much with the pandemic, but I believe you said, Ali, you know, you definitely saw a jump up in enrollment and kind of volume of interest in your services. Is that right?
Yes, we did. We did see a large uptick in enrollment during the 2021 school year. And, you know, a lot of those families did choose to stay with us even as things began to kind of normalize.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a number at all as far as what that looked like? How much enrollment increased for you guys?
Yes. Well, it's kind of hard to truly put a number on it because when prior to like just before the pandemic started, we were still a pretty new school in the state. And so our enrollment was lower because we were just kind of opening our doors and getting our feet underneath us.
You were trending up in it anyway.
Yeah. And yeah. Then the world shut down and we went. So at the end of the 2019-2020 school year, we were around 300 students. And then mm-hmm. when we went into the fall, we were, we jumped almost to 3,000.
So oh my goodness.
It was a lot, but wow. We've kind of, it's dropped back. We're currently around 1,300.
Okay.
And our teachers are still here and supporting families. And, you know, like I said, we kind of expected a little more of a drop, but no, it's been pretty steady and they're still enrolling. Enrollment is still open.
Awesome. What does a typical day look like for students at Willamette Connections Academy?
Yeah, I love this question. You know, it really does vary. I will say that because of the flexibility, but we always encourage our families to build a daily routine because absolutely everyone does better if they have some sort of structure in their day. So depending on the grade level, students can spend anywhere from about 4 to 6 hours per day doing their learning. And that is not all just sitting in front of the computer, staring at a screen, doing this and that. That is, you know, maybe attending a live lesson in the online classroom with one of their teachers. It might be doing some videos and then going and doing some worksheets or taking some notes. There's a good mix of online and offline curriculum. So we don't want kids just at the computer all day, every day. We try and help families build routines. So, you know, we wouldn't want them to, you know, just sit down and plow through all 4 to 6 hours of their work. We would definitely encourage them to take snack breaks, take walks, you know, break up the day however it best suits them to get their work done. And that can be really nice because they're not tied to, you know, 7:30 to 2:30 or, you know, 8 to 4, whatever the schedule may be that they were going to at their neighborhood school. They can make it work for them. And so, you know, our high schoolers have jobs that they work around, a lot of them. Like I said, people have extracurriculars or, you know, sports practices and things like that. So the families really do have some flexibility to make the days theirs. And so it can be kind of fun because, you know, they can do clubs and activities outside of our, you know, outside of our school, which can be fun. And then I've had families say it's just nice to have their kids with them during the day because they get to kind of learn how to go to the dry cleaner or the grocery store and kind of engage in day-to-day activities and learn some life skills along the way. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as far as that goes, you know, I know that that was something that was tough on some students and families as well. Again, when we were as a state and for all schools, excuse me, not schools, in that distance learning environment was the, you know, how do students kind of socialize with each other? Is that something that even can happen? I know a lot of schools that were transitioning and trying to build this plane as they were flying in it found that to be a challenge. Is that something that you guys have dealt with over the years at Willamette Connections Academy and kind of found some solutions to for what I'm sure you'll agree is a really, excuse me, really important part of the student experience is spending time with peers?
Absolutely. So yeah, socialization is absolutely a critical component to our learning and we support it and encourage it and do the best we can to facilitate it. So number one, the live lessons and the meetings that the students are invited to almost on a daily basis are an excellent way to start building community and socialize. So the teachers always open their rooms early and stay a little late to let the kids kind of have some chatter time. A lot of our teachers do special meetings that are just like for, you know, just for socialization, just for chatting or doing an art project or having a dance party or eating lunch together even. So those are like the smallest, you know, the littlest things that we do is just that level. But we as a school, you know, prior to the pandemic, we would go and do face-to-face field trips. So we'd say, hey, we're going to go to the Tillamook factory and we're going to, you know, so meet here or, and, you know, at this time, and it's kind of a family affair and it's really fun. And we would do that. So then the world shut down and we were unable to do the in-person things, but our teachers pivoted so well to provide virtual field trips and get-togethers. And so I can't remember the final number, but I would definitely say upwards of 150 last year, virtual field trips were offered and teachers did things like go to the Louvre or travel to Egypt or, you know, something even silly like, hey, this teacher has worms and does, I can't remember what kind, you know, to compost. And she just did a virtual field trip in her own home to introduce her worms and show them her garden.
That's so cool.
Yes, exactly. It was super cool. And the kids totally loved it. And so, you know, they got very creative on ways to do engaging things in the virtual environment. And so we're pretty proud of that. And we're going to hang on to the virtual field trips, even as the world begins to open. But we are starting to look and explore at the in-person opportunities again. In addition to what we're offering in-house, Connections Academy as a whole offers a lot of clubs and electives. And so kids can do pen pal club and interact with students at other Connections Academy schools. They can do chess club or robotics club. I mean, you name it, there's probably some sort of club that might pique your students' interest. And that's really fun too, because then sometimes you're not only engaging with students at our school, it might be students within the national Connections Academy chain. And then even with our languages, we have some international reach, which is really, really fun.
Well, you know, one thing that I really appreciate about you guys is as much as many, many families and students did have challenges and have frustrations with the online learning environment, again, when that was the only option for most families, there were some you would hear, you know, actually, this has been good for my student. You know, they've kind of actually thrived in this environment for a variety of reasons. So it's nice that, you know, for folks where that might be the case, that this option is still available to them through Willamette Connections Academy and other schools like that. I wanted to ask you just as my last question, Allie, what do you think and what have you kind of seen in general are some of the biggest benefits that students and families see from this type of learning for listeners and families who might be looking, you know, next semester and kind of weighing their options and might want to consider Willamette Connections or a similar school?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I like what you said there that, you know, families were finding, oh, my gosh, this is really cool. It's working. One thing that I've always observed, and this is my 12th year with Connections Academy, and is families find it's a family affair is what I mean to say. So it's not just like the generic conversation at the end of the day where you're like, hey, what'd you learn in school today? Our families are given the opportunity to engage with the learning and see what their kids are doing. And we ask them to review their work each day. And, you know, it's really fun because they can find these opportunities to say, oh, hey, you were working on percentages in your math class today. We're at the grocery store. This is 40% off. What's it going to cost? You know, they're going to see these opportunities to like weave it into their day-to-day learning. And that is something that they don't always get. They don't always know what's going on. And on top of that, our grade books are available to the families 24/7. And so they don't have to wait until a semester or the end of a year or when the report cards come out to say, uh-oh, what happened in that class? They're going to know right away where their kids stand, and they have the ability to help reach out to the teachers or contact them and, you know, work alongside their students to find success. And one benefit that has always stood out for many, many years in this program, I taught kindergarten. And so my job was, you know, just really to help start creating great learning foundations for the families. But I remember sitting in a high school graduation for our school one year, and I have since heard this theme echoed over and over. Because the kids are at home, and as they get older, they kind of take on being their own learning advocate and building their own schedules. And I can say so many of our kids benefit from learning how to prioritize their day. And then they feel so much more confident heading into college or the workforce or whatever it may be, because they have kind of figured out how to get it all done. And that is something I think is so valuable to them. And it's been a real eye-opener for a lot of our kids when we kind of challenge them, you know, hey, why don't you call your teacher? You know, yes, well, of course, talk to your parents, but these kids get to kind of own it. And it's kind of fun to see that as they get older. And I know many, many, many have echoed that as, you know, something that was really not expected that they would learn, but a benefit for sure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that was going to be my last question, but I lied. What you just said kind of made me think of something else. Just that you mentioned that you started and spent a long time teaching kindergarten students. I know that that was something I saw from a lot of teachers and parents, that was kind of in the distance learning environment. That was a really tough age. Seemed like high school students and older students had a little bit of easier time in general with the transition to distance learning than the very young kids. Would you, you know, did you kind of experience that was a little bit of a harder to kind of build out effective teaching models for that particular age group?
So yeah, that's a great question. And so it absolutely can be, because our little ones, if they do not have the support of someone at home to help facilitate the learning, then it's really, really, really incredibly difficult. And it made it hard in the pandemic because some parents and family members were juggling jobs and life, and we get that. But in our environment, we always tell our parents or whoever signs up to be our student's learning coach, they do not have to be a teacher or an expert in anything. We don't expect our teachers, our parents or learning coaches or the aunt or the uncle or grandma that's helping the kiddo at home to know how to teach their kid how to read or know how to do chemistry. We don't expect them to know that. What we do need is for them to just help guide the learning. And all of our curriculum built into our system is scripted. I mean, it is literally scripted to, hey, to have your students say, like it's scripted down to the, you know, the periods and commas and question marks. So we don't have them have any guesswork on how to get it done. It's just simply navigating and building a schedule that works for them. And we'll do the heavy lifting. We'll do the teaching. We will clarify and make it make sense. We just need them to have someone at home that can kind of drive the bus. That's it.
Well, Ali, it's been so great to talk to you today. Thank you so much for taking time out. Is there a place that folks can go to get more information about Willamette Connections Academy or similar learning opportunities if they so wish?
Yes, it's just www.connectionsacademy.com and then /Wilka, or you can search Willamette Connections Academy on the Connections Academy website. We do have an information session tomorrow, which is March 10th. Online, or you can get information from our website on that as well if anyone wants information.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Ali, and best of luck to you for the rest of the school year.
Thanks, Tyler. Appreciate your time today.
Summer's coming, am I right?
Oh, yeah, and spring break too, just around the corner.
All right.
Thank you.
Frankie! How many times do I have to ask you for those audio files? I need them for the next episode.
I know. Man, I told you I'm trying to upload them now, but it's taking forever.
That's super weird. I thought your new internet provider was like super fast speeds.
Well, I thought so too. I mean, sometimes it goes really fast, but then I get heavy lag and glitches when I'm trying to make FaceTime calls or play games. It has cost me quite a few missions on Call of Duty Warzone, I can tell you. Even the videos on my doorbell cam come in jittery sometimes.
Well, Frankie, other than being very bad at video games, sounds like it's trouble with your upload speeds. Most internet providers only talk about their download speeds, since those are usually way faster.
Okay, hang on a second. You're telling me there are two types of internet speeds?
Yep. And upload speed is just as important as download. Think about how much stuff we send up to the internet, like the video of you that your friends see on the FaceTime call, or the response to your commands when you're playing action video games.
You're right. It sounds like I have slow upload speeds. Wish I would have known that when I signed up for internet.
Unfortunately, a lot of providers only tout their download speeds when talking about their services. That's what sets DirectLink apart. Not only do they openly advertise them, but their upload speeds are up to 10 times faster than other providers in the area. They know how important it is to have clear video when on that Zoom interview you have for your dream job, or when you're trying to catch those porch pirates that are stealing all of your Amazon packages and the Christmas things that you got for your, you know what? It's not a big deal. Give DirectLink a call to get started at 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop/internet.
You kind of got a grudge against those.
I'm still waiting for my teddy bear to show up.
Are you a healthcare hero? Do you want to become one? Are you looking for a position where you are valued, your time is your own, and you have ample opportunity for growth? Marquee companies at Hope Village in Canby, Oregon offers all of that and more. They are currently hiring nurses, caregivers, CNAs, and enrolling students in their free CNA course. From competitive wages and up to $25,000 tuition reimbursement to flexible schedules and the opportunity to make a positive impact on someone's life, Marquee at Hope Village is the right place for you. Take your career to the next level and apply now to become a valued team member at Marquee at Hope Village in Canby. To learn more or apply today, text CURRENT, that's C-U-R-R-E-N-T, to 888-906-3432.
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily. Find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connect with them on Facebook or through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. The history of Oregon City is rife with firsts. The community was the first city west of the Rocky Mountains to be incorporated in 1844. 1 year earlier, its first school had been established on the top floor of the Main Street House, a hotel owned by Sidney Moss. Though it was in operation for less than a year, and though a school operating on the top floor of a hotel sounds more like a premise of a made-for-TV Disney movie than something that really happened, it does have the distinction of being the first known school in Oregon City and one of the first west of the Mississippi. Education was important in those early days, as settlers recognized the need for the next generation of business owners, tradespeople, politicians, workers, and other professionals to be able to measure up to those already well established in the eastern and central United States. But a nationwide or even statewide system of funding and standards for formal education and standards was still decades away from existence. In the small rural towns and trading stops that were popping up all over the Oregon Territory, it often fell to the community members themselves to establish their own schools, usually a settler's home, general store, or the town church, until a schoolhouse could be built. Residents would build their own schoolhouse, pull money together to pay for a school teacher, and have to provide their own school supplies. The earliest schoolhouses were little more than a one-room log cabin with a wood-burning stove and rough-hewn desks and benches. The floors were dirt, the windows were usually covered with greased paper, and the students worked by candlelight during the dark days of winter. Joseph Lane, a general in the Mexican-American War, who became the first governor of the Oregon Territory, appointed by President James K. Polk, sent a message to the early legislatures in 1849 recommending a system of free and public schools. Shortly after, in 1850, Reverend Dr. George Atkinson recommended building an all-female school in Oregon City on land donated by Oregon Founding Father John McLaughlin. Money was gathered for construction by many families in the area, including then-Governor George Abernathy, who loaned $6,000 to the project. By 1851, construction had reached more than $10,000, although a section of the interior was left unfinished due to economic shortfalls. Due to ongoing financial problems, the school eventually became the property of Governor Abernathy by virtue of the still unpaid loan. The Methodist Episcopal Conference bought the building and land in 1856, reopening it 5 years later as the Oregon City Seminary, a newly co-ed school headed by Reverend Dr. George Atkinson. As some of the few stable and well-funded institutions in the Pioneer West, churches and religious leaders were often instrumental in establishing, maintaining, and expanding schools in those days. Atkinson himself was a tireless force in the education of Clackamas County children and families, opening a total of 88 schools in the area in his lifetime. In 1853, Moss came back onto the scene of education in Oregon City, and he was a colorful and instrumental figure in his own right. Born in Bourbon County, Kentucky, in March of 1810, Sidney Walter Moss was a stonecutter by trade who arrived in the budding town of Oregon City in 1842. He surveyed the town for Dr. McLaughlin and filed its first plats and was the state's first recognized novelist. He established his first Main Street house on the grounds of the paper plant. Hotel might be an overly grand term. It was, in fact, a log cabin spanning fewer than 240 square feet. But a much grander two-story building would soon take shape on the corner of 3rd and Main, and it was there that Moss would eventually establish the primary school, which he financed from his own pocket. The novelist promoted his hotel with a rhyme, what might be considered today an early form of an advertising jingle. To all high or low, please down with your dust, for he's no friend of ours that would ask us to trust. Moss is also credited with founding the first hotel and first general store west of the Rockies, with the exception of Hudson Bay Company stores. In his spare time, he also built the city's first jail, serving as assessor and circuit court clerk, and ran a ferry service and a livery stable. A roguish character of whom it was often said he preferred to fight than eat, he was once convicted and fined for selling brandy to a local tribe of American Indians. When the rhymes failed to draw clients, it was his custom to stride up and down the street, ringing a cowbell to call patrons to dinner at his hotel. In 1853, nearly a decade after the first school at his hotel had opened and closed, Moss again offered space at his establishment for a free school, even going so far as to offer to house the teacher and provide free board for up to 3 years. In 1854, the local territorial legislature passed an act to create a school district in Oregon City, which gave the city council the power to act as a school board. One of their first actions was, in May 1855, to accept Moss's generous offer. After the three-year deal ended, the school moved from the hotel to a building owned by McLaughlin, located in the lower part of town, which the city rented for $8 a month. Dr. Forbes Barclay, the city's first school superintendent, was elected in March 1857, and he soon suggested the school be moved to and essentially merged with the Oregon City Seminary in a deal that would retain Reverend Atkinson as principal. The property was deeded to the city council in 1867 to be used for a free and public school, becoming the first publicly owned school property in the city. In the 1870s, the city council agreed to relinquish control of the school, and school district number 62 was officially formed on November 13, 1874. After nearly 40 years of continuous use, the old seminary building was torn down in 1889 to make way for a six-room replacement that would become known as the Barclay School. Barclay was just one of many locals at that time, including 7th Street School, later called Eastham, Kanama, Lower Logan, Beaver Creek, Maple Lane, Mount Pleasant, Park Place, Holcomb, Crescent, Henrici, Hazeldale, Twilight, Jennings Lodge, Claremont, and Echo Dell. Newer versions of several of these schools still functioned in the district well into the 20th century. Oregon City High School was established in 1885, but the first high school building would not be constructed in 1910 on the corner of 12th and John Adams. It opened to students in September 1911. The district grew so rapidly that in 1915, a bond was approved to expand the facilities, and by 1936, a new three-story brick building was built. When the high school population was moved to the new building, the former site became Oregon City Junior High, which operated as such from 1936 to 1955. Sadly, by 1954, the building was overcrowded with more than 500 students and was deemed unsafe. Voters passed a bond proposal to build a middle school named after Thora B. Gardner, an Icelandic immigrant who was active in a wide variety of church, civic, and club affairs, and who, as a member of the school board, was instrumental in the founding of Oregon City High School, Barclay School, Eastham School, and the merging of Park Place District with Oregon City. Ogden Junior High School came along in 1965, followed by Moss Junior High School in 1976. Moss was closed in 1985 and converted to a freshman-only campus, opening in 1989, leaving the Oregon City High School with only 10th through 12th graders. Due to changing districts and budget shortfalls in 1985, Barclay Elementary was closed and the students were rerouted to other local elementary schools. Eastham Elementary followed, being shuttered in 1992, although the district repurposed the building and opened it as a community schools hub. In the early 2000s, construction began on the Moss campus for the new high school, often referred to as Beaver Creek. With its completion in 2003, OCHS became a four-year high school again for the 2003-2004 school year. The original 1885 campus on Jackson was closed in 2003 due to the after effects of multiple disasters, fires and earthquakes, and the inability to effectively repair the damage. Pioneer Memorial Stadium, adjacent to the 1885 campus, continues as the OCHS venue for football, soccer, lacrosse, and track and field.
And now, a message from Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to take this moment to invite you personally to come and hang out with us for our end of season client event. It's a thank you to all the wonderful people we've done business with, as well as a welcome to a lot of our community. I'm doing this in partnership with Vanessa Zimmerman, Zimmerman team at Academy Mortgage. It's just kind of our way of saying thank you. We've really enjoyed getting to know you, doing business with you, etc. We'll be outside. We're sensitive to the fact that we're in COVID, still dealing with that. So it will be spread out. People will have room to breathe and sit and walk and talk. Reckless Company, if you've never heard them before, they're awesome. They're going to be playing. We'll have TMK here. I can't wait to try the corn dog. I've been waiting like 2 years to try this corn dog. So it looks amazing, and I've heard it's amazing, and I think there's quite a following. Also, they'll have all kinds of other food. We'll have beer and cider. Everything's hosted, of course, as a thank you. Again, it's for our clients. It's for our community. We really, really want to come and celebrate. We'll have swag for you, all kinds of fun things for the kids. We hope to see you on 9/16 from 4 to 8 in the afternoon.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't, like, animal-related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest-running, locally-owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately, like, caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net.
Now Hear This, Camby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.